Well, we're honored tonight to have two special guests with us. We've got Don N. from Moorhead, Minnesota, and Arbutus O. from Brownwood, Texas. And I'm just going to turn it over to you two and whatever you want to do.
Do you want to start at the initial?
No, I think I'll let you do that, Don.
If you don't mind, I'll stand.
He comes first, yeah. N becomes 4-0.
My name is Don, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Don.
And I'm sober tonight for the living grace of God and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in case you're some newcomers here tonight, I should tell you, you never really know what you're going to hear at an AA meeting, which reminds me of the story of the Roman Catholic priest who went out to visit the convent one day. And when he got to the convent, he was met by the Mother Superior, who was all wrought up and distressed and anxious and uptight. And he looked at her, he said, "Good heavens, woman, what's the matter with you?" And she says, "Father, we have a terrible problem in the convent." "Well," the good father says, "tell me what the problem is, and perhaps I can be of some assistance." She says, "No, Father, this is not a problem of a spiritual nature." And he said, "No, just a moment. We priests live in the local community. We have a lot of experience in many areas of life. It doesn't have to just be a spiritual thing. Tell me what the problem is." "Well," she said, "the nuns bought a pet." He said, "That's great." He says, "No, Father, it's terrible, because the pet they bought was a talking budgie bird." And the good father said, "Well, I see nothing wrong with that." She says, "Father, the only thing that little bird does is swings all day long in this little swing. It swings back and forth. And the only thing this bird will say is, 'Root, toot, toot, I'm a prostitute.' Now, you know, the nuns and novices and postulants have tried everything to teach this bird to say something else. She won't do it. It's awfully demoralizing. We're at our wit's end. We don't know what to do." Well, the good father says, "I told you it pays to talk about your problems. Because, you see, I, too, happen to be a bird lover. And I have two talking budgie birds myself down in my apartment." And he says, "My birds are so intelligent and they speak so well that I had a Bible made up in miniature and also a rosary. And all day long, my two birds, who are called Clyde and Clive, they read the Bible and pray aloud all day long." And the Mother Superior said, "That is unbelievable." He said, "I'll tell you what, I'll take your bird down and expose your bird to my two birds, and maybe they'll be able to teach your bird to say something else." Mother Superior said, "Fine." She got the cage, gave it to good father. He got in his car and went down to his apartment in town. As he walked in the door, he looked up at his cage, and sure enough, there was Clyde and Clive standing in the bottom of the cage, and they were praying and reading the Bible. So he took the nun's budgie out of his cage and popped it in with his two and stood back to watch. And right away, the nun's budgie got in the top swing, swung back and forth, and says, "Root, toot, toot, I'm a prostitute." And with that, Clyde turned to Clive. He said, "Clive, you can throw away the beads and book. Our prayers have just been answered." So as I say, you never know. I was told that I'm supposed to talk something about sponsorship. And one of the things that we do to me, this is one of the most important things in Alcoholics Anonymous, is getting a sponsor. And I say that for a very good reason, because we're dealing with something that is tangible and something that is intangible. Now, by tangible, I mean something like this glass case. We can see it, taste it, touch it, smell it, feel it. We all know it's there, and there's no doubt in anybody's mind that's very tangible. But if I were to talk to you about the oxygen in this room, you'd be a little puzzled, because, you know, oxygen is an intangible. You can't see it, you can't taste it, touch it, smell it, feel it, or anything else. But it's here nevertheless. And I think we all agree that there is oxygen in this room. If anybody doubts it, if you let me hold your nose with two fingers and put the rest of my hand over your mouth for 10 minutes, would you permit that? None of you would do that, because you'd say, "No way, because I have to breathe and I have to get oxygen to survive, and I would die if I didn't get my oxygen." And so the thing is that we have faith in the oxygen. But before we could have faith in the oxygen, we had to trust the scientists who told us all about oxygen and where it came from, and we accept his word. And through trust, we learn faith. And that's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. Before we can have faith in a higher power, we have to learn to trust a human being, because trust is the beginning of faith. And it's for that reason that we have a sponsor, more than anything else. And the thing is, you get a sponsor because if you have to level with him or her, whichever the case may be, probably for the first time in our lives, because I know all through my life I could tell each so much, a little bit about myself to many people, but I would never tell one all about me, because that would be real problems. I also, when I got into the program, found in the big book where it says in our fifth step, we had to tell all our life story. And I said, you mean all, everything? And they said, yes. That's why that word all is in italics, to make it stand right out so you can't miss. Because see, I wouldn't have minded telling them about the things I did when I was drinking, because, you know, there's always kind of an excuse for that. And they'd always say, you know, I'd never have done that if I hadn't been drinking. Of course, that's nonsense. But they said, we have to tell everything, the things I did even in between those drinking bouts. And so I had to trust a human being before I had faith in a higher power. And that's why it's necessary we have a sponsor, and we use that sponsor on a regular basis. As we grow older, of course, it's like anything else. As we begin to grow, we start sponsoring other people, and we need less and less as time goes on, as we learn more and more. There's many things that my sponsors taught me, and one of the greatest things they ever taught me was definition of the English language, words in the English language. Now, I will admit that I had two big advantages over most people when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the two advantages I had was that I was dumb and I was broke when I landed on your doorstep. And the reason I say that those were big advantages, in all the years that I have been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never yet met anyone that was too dumb to understand this program. But I've met many that were far too well educated to understand this simple program. And I have never yet met anyone that was too broke to get this program, but I've met many people who had far too much money to get the program. And so by being dumb and broke is really a big advantage. And so I started off, and it hadn't been for sponsorship and the love and care they had for me, because the first meeting I attended back then, AA was just a little over 12 years old when I first came, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't want to go to that meeting, because I was convinced I was not an alcoholic and I didn't want to associate with alcoholics or any of this sort of thing. And of course, even if I might be a little bit alcoholic, this AA wouldn't work for me anyway, because see, I'm different. And I was such a sensitive person, and nobody had ever understood me my whole life. My family had never understood me. My teachers never understood me. Nobody had ever understood me. And if you had problems like that, you'd take a drink on occasion too. And but I was finessed into going to that meeting, and I went to that first meeting, and there's four fellas there, and AA was very small then, and of course they started sharing in a general way what they used to be like, and as they were talking I started listening, and then I started figuring it all out, and I figured, what has happened? Those guys have talked to her, she's told them all about me. And now they're saying they did those things, just try to suck me into this thing. If they think I'm stupid enough to go along with that, they're crazy. And then they got into that area that she didn't know anything about. And I knew she didn't know anything about that. She wouldn't have been still with me if she knew about some of those things. And I got very suspicious, and finally I blurted out, I said, how come you guys know so much about me? And they said, oh, we're not talking about you, Don. This is just when we're saying what we used to be like and what happened, this is just a projection of the basic symptoms of alcoholism. And I said, well, I've done all those things and I'm not an alcoholic. I know they just looked at each other and smiled and kept right on going like I didn't exist, you know. And they kept on going. And the more they talked, the more I identified. And in those days, of course, this was back in February of 1948, an AA meeting lasted as long as it took them to convince that newcomer to come back to the next meeting. And I was there right at 8 o'clock sharp when the meeting started, and I got home at 2:30 in the morning. And of course, that's the way it went in those days. They weren't going to let a live one get away on them. So they kept on going, and I started going on a regular basis. And I didn't, of course, I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I had all kinds of these other problems. And then as time went on, I started thinking, I wonder if there's a possibility that I might be an alcoholic. And then it got to, you know, I probably am. And then I must be an alcoholic. And it was about 10 months and going to meetings that finally decided, no longer I must be an alcoholic, and I am an alcoholic. And I finally admitted that I was. And then they, of course, that's a very important thing to understand. Because the first step says we admit we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And that's why I needed a sponsor, because he had to get some management into my life. Now, if we know anything about management, the American Management Association defines good management does not solve problems. That's bad management. Good management prevents problems. And so they had to teach me all the things that I needed to prevent the problems that I was getting in my life. They told me that first of all, I must go to a regular meeting that meets at the same time, same place every week. And I said, you mean if I miss a meeting, I'll get drunk? And they said, no, that's not it at all. But if you came from an alcoholic home, the only thing that's consistent in that type of home is the inconsistency. And so we must go to a regular meeting that meets same time, same place every week. Because by doing that, we're living our way into right thinking, we start becoming consistent. And once we get consistency in our lives, then we can start getting self-discipline. But you can't have self-discipline without consistency. And so this is where the program is such a wonderful thing for people like me that came from these, quote, dysfunctional homes. I mean, now they call it dysfunctional homes. It almost gives it sound like a touch of class. But back in those days, I say the old man was a drunk, and so was my older brother. But now they have a fancy name for everybody. So the only thing that's similar now, I think, is my wife. She used to refer to me with a term, something like to do now. I think she used to refer to me as her insignificant other. So that's probably the only thing that's different, slightly different than the same. So they taught me that how to live, I had to start doing certain things. And all my life, you see, I've been trying to think my way into right living, and that was the problem. We can't do that. I was doing everything backwards. And we have to live our way into right thinking. Now, of course, we had, in those days, we didn't have any women at the meetings or anything like that. We didn't know there were any women alcoholics. We knew very little about alcoholism. But they did know many things, not to teach us how to live. And so they taught us those things. They taught me the definition of many, many words. One of the words they told me was honesty. They said, you have to get honest with yourself. And they said, of course, you know what that means? And I said, yes, of course. And they said, what does it mean? And I really didn't have a definition. And so my sponsor wrote it out in a placemat. And he said, honesty is the total absence of any intent to deceive. And see, I'm the kind of person who put a letter, my wife gave me a letter going out in the morning to mail. I put it in my inside pocket. I come home that night and God, I forgot the letter. She'd say to me, did you mail my letter? And I'd look at her and say, what do you think I did with it? And she'd say, now, wait a minute, Donald, did you mail my letter? And I says, my God, woman, you know, I go right out of this house every morning, right down past the post office on my way to my office. And she said, did you mail my letter? I said, do you remember the other night we were arguing about what's gone wrong with this marriage? You have never, ever trusted me from day one. And you don't trust me even to do a simple thing like mail a letter. And she says, well, I'm sorry, I asked. And I said, well, you should be. And I come sit down, I pick up the newspaper. Now, I didn't lie to her, I didn't think, you know. Because now, if she wanted to jump to the conclusion that I had mailed it, that was her problem. But, of course, that's what sponsorship does. It shoots down all those things by teaching me the definition of honesty. They also told me in the big book that selfishness and self-centeredness was my problem. And the way the antidote to that is to practice humility. And I didn't know the difference between humility and humiliation. And so they taught me that humility is not thinking less of me, but thinking of me less. Not thinking less of me, but thinking of me less. And once we start thinking of ourselves less and start thinking of other people, then the program is starting to work in our lives. And all these things come through sponsorship. And it's so important that we have this sponsorship. And often, that, you know, as I say, it is important. It's Of course, in my case, it's hard for me to get a sponsor because so many of them have died on me. I don't know whether it's because of me or what. But really, I guess it's just old age on their part. But, the thing is, we've also learned that there's been many changes over the years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of those changes is something like the same one when I was a child growing up. There was a disease called consumption. And maybe there's not many white-haired people here. You'll remember it. I viewed as well. There's a disease called consumption. And it was a terrible disgrace if you had a member of your family that was consumptive. You wouldn't tell your best friend. And the only way a doctor would recognize consumption if you went to see them, you had a terrible hacking cough, you were very anemic looking, and probably had a collapsed lung. And so the medical profession got busy, and they started working on the disease. And as they learned more about it, they found out it had nothing to do with morality, it had nothing to do with willpower, it had nothing to do with spirituality or anything else, it was simply a disease. And so they went on a program to educate the general public at large. At the same time, they changed the name to tuberculosis. And as you know today, it's no disgrace to be tubercular. In Canada and many countries of the world, every child must have a chest x-ray, prior to starting school. And the reason for that x-ray is if there's just a simple spot on the lung, they have to be treated, it's compulsory to be treated for tuberculosis, because it is contagious and it can affect other people in your family and around you. And of course, we're finding the same thing with alcoholism. It's just as bad. It affects many people around us. We didn't know in the beginning what alcoholism was all about. It wasn't until 1980 that the geneticists came up with the description. They said that the physical sensitivity to alcohol is, quote, a biochemical genetic disorder, which means it is hereditary, whether we like it or not. And so we have to accept that. And the fact that we are emotionally and spiritually handicapped. If there's anybody new in the room, we use the word in AA, we say emotionally and spiritually handicapped, or emotionally or spiritually immature. And that's to go easy on your feelings, because we're such sensitive people. But really what it means is we're emotionally and spiritually retarded. But you know, alcoholics don't like being called retarded for some reason. They don't mind if they've got a cousin retarded or a neighbor that's retarded, but by God, don't call me retarded. So what we do is we sugarcoat that pill and say it's emotional and spiritual handicap or immaturity, but it really means we're retarded. And so once we understand those things, the rest of the program, and through our sponsorship, regular attendance at meetings, we learn how to live again. And we start having to do certain things so that we can catch up to life. And as time goes on, it becomes real challenge, and it becomes very, very interesting. There's many other things we learn. As time has gone on, we didn't wait. You don't have to wait till you're 55 or 60 years of age and lose everything before you're diagnosed as an alcoholic. The best description that I've ever seen of alcoholism is in the Alateen book. And there they say that many of the symptoms of alcoholism are in the behavior of the alcoholic. And that is so true. We can tell by the behavior whether a person's alcoholic or not. And that is so typical. And so that is another thing. So we're emotionally handicapped and spiritually handicapped. This emotional handicap is a tough thing to have, simply because when we're handicapped emotionally, we don't mature, and therefore we have other problems. But you know, as children we're very dependent, and as teenagers we're independent, and then we reach an adulthood and we become interdependent. But alcoholics never reach the adulthood. They're dependent as children, and then they reach teenage and we become independent, and we're going to remain independent forever. And nobody's going to tell me what to do. So we're 21, 31, 41, I'm independent. Which all we're doing is waving a flag saying, look how retarded I am emotionally. But we don't realize that. That's true, because you stop and look at the alcoholic behavior. I see, quote, non-alcoholics enter into interpersonal relationships. Alcoholics don't. We take hostages. You know, she is mine, and by God, I want to know where she is every hour of every minute of every day. And I get insanely jealous of her and everything else. I hate to admit I was jealous of my first sponsor, because he was talking more to my wife than he was to me, it seemed. And of course, that was necessary in those days. And so we have to learn, and as you know, all know, what's uppermost in every hostage's mind is one day I'll escape from this situation. And some of them are fortunate enough to do that. Others hang around, and if we get into AA, that's fine. And they have a wonderful program of Al-Anon that can help the families of alcoholics, because our whole family is affected by the disease of alcoholism. But these things are very necessary. It's like that regular meeting. I must go to a regular meeting at the same time, same place, and I must have a sponsor. And I do this for a very specific reason. And the reason for that is, the best way to describe my alcoholism is to compare it to another condition I was familiar with at the time I got to AA. And this is a condition known as BO, body odor. I think you all know what I'm talking about. And the reason I say my alcoholism was like body odor, I was the last person in town to find out that I had it. Everybody knew it but me. Now, isn't that like body odor? If you've got BO, you're always the last to know. If you suddenly just find out you've got it, you'll run into your friends and say, "By God, I've discovered I've got BO." And they all say, "Thank God," you know, because they can't stand you. But again, like BO, being the last to find out I had it, I resented any reference to it by my family or friends. If somebody came up to me and says, "You know, you smell bad, why don't you take a bath?" I wouldn't say, "Oh, thanks very much, I wasn't aware." I'd get very defensive and uptight and want to punch them out. And say, "Well, it's too bad you've never had to work for a living," and blah, 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 blah. And so it was about my drinking. If you talked about my drinking, I got very uptight and very defensive. Another thing like BO, my alcoholism, was like I was only comfortable with other people like myself. Now, if we decide to stay here, if there's three or four people in this room with BO, and we just close the windows and it gets a lot warmer in here and decide to have coffee and cookies after the meeting, I'll guarantee in no time at all, you'll find that three or four with BO all clustered together away from the rest of the group. Because, you know, there's something strange, and if I notice a strange odor about me, and I'll move over beside Arbutus, and I'm still coming on pretty strong, and I'll move over here, and then over there, and finally I'll meet for somebody that's smells a little worse than me, and somebody else, and that's great, I'll stay with them. If somebody says, "There's a strange odor here," I'd say, "Yeah, you know, them." And that's it. And so it's the same thing with drinking. You know, you watch, go to any drinking party, you'll always find a little group of drunks, the alcoholics, all clustered together, drinking in between drinks, usually feeling sorry for the rest of the people. So you see, the other thing about that is, and BO, that medical science, as great as it is today, has not yet come up with a cure. There's no known cure in the world today for either body odor or for alcoholism. However, there is successful treatment for both conditions. Now, if body odor is your problem, successful treatment is regular bathing with soap and water. But now the key to that is regularity. It must be done on a regular, consistent basis. I can't go before I go out today and say, go into the bathroom and have five showers and then decide to go out and live in my car for a whole week to save money on hotel rooms. Anybody think I was stupid if I did that? But yet we have members of Alcoholics Anonymous who think they can skip meetings here, there, and at random anywhere, and they think they're going to grow emotionally and spiritually. They aren't. It's the same thing. It's very bad. And when people say to me, "But Don, you know, you like those meetings. You know, it's different." I just don't like going to all those meetings. And I say, "Who says I like them?" And they said, "Well, you must like them. You go to so many." Well, what they're really saying to me is, and they say, "You know, how long have you been sober now?" And I say, 41 years. And they say, "Boy, you know, why do you still go to those meetings? If you haven't had a drink for 41 years, why do you go?" Well, I'm no genius, but I figured this one out all by myself. Really, what they're saying to me is, "Don, you know, you haven't smelled bad for 41 years. Why do you still bathe?" No, isn't that what they're saying? The same thing exactly. And so I say, well, the reason I don't smell is because I bathe on a regular basis, every single day, as a matter of fact. Now, that doesn't mean, by the way, that I like bathing and shaving, but I bathe and shave 7 days a week. The reason for that is I have six grandchildren, two grandsons and four granddaughters. And they come up and hug me and kiss me and say, "Oh, Grandpa, you smell so good." I know there's a lot of band parents who lose the love of those children because they smell like old goats, you know? And that's just too bad. But I've discovered that by keeping clean and being shaved and clean, that I get lots of hugs, and same at the group and our group back in Moorhead after meeting, you know, the guys will come up and hug you and the girls and hug you and say, oh, you smell so good. And there must be something wrong with you, but I love being hugged, you know? Yeah. So I don't bathe and shave because I love bathing and shaving, but I love the effect it produces in my life. Does that make sense to everybody? It makes sense to me. The reason I bathe and shave is because I love the effect it produces in my life. It's the same thing with regular meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular, consistent basis. It doesn't necessarily mean I like meetings, but I love the effect it produces in my life. And that's why I do all these things on a regular basis. We've changed, the evolutionary changes taking place in AA. The average age keeps coming down. The groups are changing, they're growing. They have a lot of women. The group that I belong to has a little over 100 at a closed meeting on Thursday nights in Moorhead. One third of them are women, and over 40% of the group are under 30 years of age. And so we have to learn how to live. And some of the things we do is that in our meetings, we don't use profanity of any kind whatsoever, because profanity is the attempt of a feeble mind to express itself forcefully. And so keep that in mind when you're tempted to just run off at the mouth. And the other reason we're learning how to live in mixed company is we're learning how to become ladies and gentlemen. And really, that's not a big problem, because all a gentleman is a man who treats every woman as a lady. And a lady is just a woman who treats every man as a gentleman. And so we learn these things, and this is why things change for us so dramatically. If we get to a regular meeting, we get a sponsor, and we're sincere with our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can't overemphasize the importance of sponsorship and regular attendance at meetings of AA. And so, in keeping with all the things they say to be a good speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous, you stand up to be seen, you speak up to be heard, and you shut up to be appreciated. So I'll shut up now.
Good job. I think Don must have taught sixth grade one time. He can't talk sitting down. And neither can I. My name is Arbutus O'Neill, and it is by the grace of God that I belong to the Al-Anon family groups.
Hi, Arbutus.
I don't have to explain that to a group of Al-Anon people, and I'd like to see how many Al-Anon members we have here. There you go. I believe we outnumber them, Cindy. I think I'll explain that to the AA people. I say, by the grace of God, I belong to the Al-Anon family groups. I didn't find out that drinking was a sin until I moved to Texas in 1944. I grew up in the Carolinas, and you have to admit that we make the best bourbon in the world. And drinking was not sinful in my peer group. It was an income for most of my friends' families, and they were not bootleggers. They worked in the distilleries and things like that. And it is by the grace of God that I belong to the Al-Anon Family Group Fellowship and not the AA program. I used to say I drank enough booze to float a battleship, but Bill said that was a lot of booze. So maybe I didn't. But anyway, getting drunk does not make an alcoholic is the point that I want to make. I've been as drunk as most AA ladies, I'm sure. Probably drank a lot more booze than some women who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But my body chemistry protected me, and I had nothing to do with my body chemistry. I did not make my eyes gray, nor did I make my own body chemistry. It is by the grace of God. Enough for that. Now, Don talked about the necessity of having a sponsorship if you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been in some parts of the country who felt that sponsorship was not necessary for Al-Anon members, and that's tragic. Because we need sponsors just as much as AA people do. You see, we don't have two programs. We have one program and two fellowships. Those of you who have alcoholism go to AA meetings to stop your compulsion to drink and to maintain your sobriety. I go to Al-Anon meetings to change my attitude about somebody else's drinking. So my reason for going to a meeting is different from the AA people. Don, I think, made as good a talk as I've ever heard on
the importance of and what sponsorship is for. But he didn't talk very much about how do you go about getting one and this kind of thing. And I think this is a puzzlement to new people. Sometimes someone will pick you up and take you to your first meeting, for example, and you're grateful. And then when the suggestion is made that perhaps you've been in a fellowship long enough now to get a sponsor, it's an automatic thing to choose the lady who took you to your first meeting. And that person might not be right to be your sponsor. And it is not necessary to choose a sponsor right in your own group. This causes a lot of confusion. So when you have grown to the point, and that should be pretty quick, that you feel like you need a sponsor to help you learn the things that Don talked about so beautifully, you look the group over and you find someone that you can identify with. Furthermore, you find someone who works the kind of program you would like to work. And you go to that person and you say, will you be my sponsor? This is a commitment on the parts of two people. The person may say, I'm sorry. I'm overloaded with people that I sponsor. I don't have time. And you have to accept that. But when you make the commitment as a sponsor, and when you're looking for a sponsor particularly, find out if your sponsor has a sponsor. I haven't been in the fellowship as long as Don has. I've been in as long as is possible, however, because Al-Anon only started 38 years ago, and I've been here ever since, and a few years besides. But, and I have a pretty much of a reputation. I think some of you might know that. I have a reputation of being a smart aleck, and I earned it. Oh, law. I worked hard for it. I earned it. And someone said to me one time, as big a smart aleck as you are, I'm quite surprised that you didn't ask Lois Wilson to be your sponsor. And I didn't. But Lois Wilson is my sponsor's sponsor. So I got pretty close to the top. But the thing about this sponsorship, when you make this commitment, it's a lasting thing. And you will tell your sponsor or ask your sponsor questions that you wouldn't ask your own mother or your own sister. I say this a lot of times, if I get in an emergency, I'll call a member of Al-Anon, then I'll notify my family because I have my priorities pretty straight right now. But I was one of those smart alecks who came to this program when I was 29 years old. And I fell into a group of family groupers down in Abilene, Texas. There were seven of them. One of the women was twice my age, and I worried about her. I thought she'd die before the meeting was over. Now I look around the room, and all of you could be my grandchildren. And I'm so grateful I didn't verbalize it. I never shall forget what I thought at the first family group meeting that I ever went to. And like Don, I didn't think there was anything wrong with me. I certainly didn't come here to get my husband sober. I'd long resigned myself to the fact that he'd probably smash another car or two, and I'd scoop him up off the Texas highway and give him a decent burial and go home where I belong. And I've been in Texas now all these years. But I looked at those dear ladies, and what I thought was, what in the name of God are you doing here? How do you expect a group of provincial Texas housewives to help you? To put it a little simpler, I was an intellectual snob. I listened to how people said things and not to what they said. There was a dear man in our group who butchered the King's English in a way that was just made me shudder. And I complained about this to Bill one night when we had an open meeting. I said, honey, please don't ask Perry to read the preamble. He was an alcoholic, and the old preamble used to say that alcoholism, and the way he said it, alcoholism is devastating, and if allowed to continue means death or loss of sanity. And I said, don't let him read the preamble. We've got out-of-town people, and so-and-so's a doctor. And Bill said, Arbus, if you listen to what that old gentleman said instead of how he said it, you would learn a great deal. And so I did. But I wasn't permitted to choose my first sponsor. Now get the picture. I'm number 8 in the group, and then we got a transplant from California who knew somebody named Chuck and Elsa Chamberlain. Oh, Lordy. And that pretty little gray-eyed Texas gal came home and found us. And that early group of mine had incorporated the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the marriage ceremony, and they read this as a preamble to every meeting. And I sat there and squirmed. And Guy tricked me into going to my first reading, the first of the regular meetings that I have continued for 38 years. I had pneumonia for 8 consecutive years when I came to Texas, always in February. I think I was trying to escape. But Guy came over to my house one afternoon, and she suggested that she keep care of the children while I went to the hairdresser. She said, I always feel better when I get my hair done if I've been in bed for a few weeks, and I do too. So I went along to the hairdresser and got my hair done, and when I came back, she said, it would be such a shame to waste that hairdo. Let's go to a meeting. And they read the rigmarole, and those little size 5 shoes of hers hit the floor. And to say she turned that group around is an understatement. She really did. We had a meeting on Monday night and one on Thursday night. Now, I'm trying to hold down a job 52 hours a week, run a 12-room house, keep 4 children in school, and my husband on his sales territory. Well, now, under the pre-Al-Anon schedule that I kept, we didn't do anything on weekends. Everything had to be polished and shined up when Daddy comes home. The meals were put ready to be warmed up before microwaves were ever heard of. And we kind of coasted, but they did, while I went to work on Saturday. Monday mornings, the place looked like a herd of buffalo had gone through it, and so Mondays were not my best days. And they had a meeting on Monday night, of course, as usual, and I was the only thing on the agenda. Those 8 ladies sat down among themselves to try to determine which one of them had the courage to be my sponsor. Guy Neal was a clinical psychologist. I did not know that. I would not have stayed in the same room with him. But she allowed that she could handle the situation. So she came over to my house and told me she was my sponsor. Now, I'm a quick study. When I first came to Texas, I found out that those Southern Baptist people, Father Fred calls them old SBs, it was awfully easy to shock those dear little ladies. And I had a ball. And the best way you could shock them was to tell them you do not believe in God. They'd just go. They'd cross the street, wouldn't speak to them. So Guy came to my house and she said, I'm your sponsor. Well, I didn't have much time to spend with the dear lady because I had things to do, you know, like worry and boss and nag. But I knew I wouldn't have her long, and so she started in this little rigmarole, and she said, have you come to terms with the first step? And I said, yes, of course I have. I said, the step says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and everybody's powerless over alcohol, Guy. It's a chemical. And I polished it off with saying I'm also powerless over strychnine and carbolic acid. And she let me get both. And I said, you don't think I'd go to those cockamamie meetings if my life was manageable to you. But I wanted to get rid of her as quickly as I could, and so I jumped ahead of her. You know, step 2 doesn't use the word God. It doesn't use that word until we get to 3. But I said to Guy, we're going to have trouble with the second step because, see, I don't believe in God. And she didn't bat an eye. She didn't even flinch. She looked at me with those cool gray eyes of hers, kind you can't lie to. And she said, that's all right, Arbutus. God believes in you. God believes in you. And I was hooked. That was more years than some of you have been alive ago. And it still intrigues me. God believes in me. I was then almost 30 years old. I had never had anybody to ask me if I believed in God. Never. I attended Duke University, which is a Methodist institution. And in my generation, you were on meetings. The chapel seats are numbered. And if you missed two chapel sessions, you talk to the dean. W.J. Martin's granddaughter didn't talk to anybody she didn't want to, and I never went to chapel. But no one had ever asked me if I believed in God. And that little gray-eyed lady said to me, God believes in you. I hear AA people and some Al-Anon people talk about multiple sponsors. And I don't understand that. I'm not... My loyalties are pretty limited. I'm a one-man woman. I've been married to Bill O'Neill for over 50 years, a few months. And I can't divide my feelings. And this is a feeling program. Alcoholism affects our feelings. And as Don so beautifully explained, we can't think ourselves into right actions. We have to act ourselves into right thinking or feeling. If this was a thinking program, I'm smart enough to get out of the box. But my feelings got mixed up in it. So I've never had but one sponsor at a time. I outlived my first sponsor. She died in 1965, and I went around in an emotional vacuum for a while until I had the courage to ask someone else to be my sponsor. My problem was the same as Don's. I couldn't find very many people in those years who had been in the program longer than I had been in the program. And I was too egotistical to ask a younger person in the program or a younger person in age to be my sponsor. So I went around in this kind of emotional vacuum, which is very, very dangerous. And then I met Margaret Doherty. Now please notice, I can tell you who my sponsor is, but there's a very thin line of anonymity involved in sponsorship. I do not have the privilege of telling you who I sponsor. That's an ego trip. Margaret Doherty was the editor of the Al-Anon Family Group Forum for 20 years. And actually, I have a fixation for Margaret. She's older than my mother would be if she were alive. And I kind of made a substitution there, I'm pretty sure. But Margaret's tough. Oh, Lord, she's tough. And she snorts. She's the best snorter I ever saw. And when I'd go to her with one of my little picayune things, the first thing she ever said to me, she said, Arbus, you're not aware of it, but everything you say, you preface it with Bill thinks, or Bill says, or Bill feels. And she said, I have no intention of sponsoring Bill O'Neill. I don't ever want to hear you say that again. So I'd call her, you know, with a great big emotional crisis, and she'd listen to me. And then she'd say, what does Bill think about this? So Bill Seduce was sponsor. But this gal was the one who put my nose down into this thing called spirituality. I was like Don. I didn't know the difference in religion and spirituality, and I wanted nothing whatever to do with religion. It scared the daylights out of me. And Margaret was the one who clarified those points for me. Now, something sponsors do not do very often, they'll send you back to school so you can get an education to get a better job. I do that on a regular basis. When somebody grasps that don't have enough education to get a better job, I'll say, well, you're in walking distance to State University, get over there and get you an education. I might even give you car fire for a few weeks to get till you get settled into the routine, but I won't loan you money. I'd give you money, but I won't loan anybody, not my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, or the people I sponsor. I'm not in the money lending business. And this is very important. Now, we say, of course, the sponsors do not give advice. You want to bet? But this is another area that in which you should exercise a great deal of caution. If your sponsor cuts through that line of privacy, I think you should be aware of this. And you don't need a mother or a father, as the case might be. You need a friend. Mature people don't need parents. That's why I can't go along with this adult children thing. It's a contradictory thing. You can't be an adult if you're a child, and you can't be shouldn't be a child if you're an adult. But sponsorship is a sharing. And as you grow in sponsorship, you will learn more from the people you sponsor in many cases than you learn from your own sponsor. My sponsor's in a rest home now. Her hearing is so defective that I can't even talk to her on the telephone. And it's been a couple of years now since she's been able to answer the letters I write. And the only communications that we have, and that's not as much as I would like, is with a tape recorder. So I gain my insight. I gain a great deal from people who are a generation younger than I am that I sponsor. I'm learning about the difference in lifestyle that I don't understand, and I don't have to. You see, we don't have to learn. We don't have to understand alcoholics. We don't even have to understand the people we sponsor. We just have to love them and accept them. And many commitments that I was able to make when I was in my late 20s and early 30s seem to be impossible for this new generation. And I'm not in the judging business. Don't ever ask me to forgive you, because I cannot. I cannot forgive you because I have not condemned you. And I find that the lifestyle of many people that I sponsor, I have to do a lot of thinking about it before I answer a question. And I was telling Don and Cindy earlier this evening, a little lady came over to my house this last month and asked me to be her sponsor. She's 28 years old, and she's been married 5 times. She has children by 3 different fathers. I don't believe she even has a secondary education. I'll find that out later. May send her back to school. She said she wanted me to be her sponsor because she identified with me. I'm old enough to be her grandmother. I've been married to the same man for 50 years. When I taught school, I had a morals clause in my contract. If I was even seen coming out of a place that served alcoholic beverages, I could forget my job. I don't know what might have happened if I'd flirted with the basketball coach. but the lifestyle is much different. And I think those of you who are Al-Anon will understand this when I say to you, it is much harder to work this program. Those of us who love alcoholics have a harder time working the program than you do, you alcoholics. Because, you see, we were not forced into this thing by the threat of death or insanity. The majority of people come to Al-Anon because someone they love is in trouble. And that's one of the finest motives in the world. This is as close to divinity that we will ever know, is to lay down our life for someone we love. And that we literally did. That we literally did, because the disease of alcoholism destroyed our very reason for existence, just as it destroyed you. But the tools are there, and I think that any group that fails to tell newcomers that one of the tools of recovery is good sponsorship is cheating their group. And I'm sure that you're not doing that in Montana, because I saw a lot of Al-Anons go up in an open AA meeting, and the best of all is that you're studying the big book. Now, I'll say this to you, and I may have to leave town in a hurry. If alcoholism caused you a few slight inconveniences, by all means, go to the nearest Al-Anon group literature table and grab up every bit of the literature and go home and sin no more. But if alcoholism fragmented your life, destroyed your motivation, destroyed your faith in God, your confidence in your husband's sobriety, and alienated you from every human being that you ever knew, if that's what alcoholism did to you, because the person you loved had alcoholism, for God's sake, get you a big book and find recovery. Thank you very much.
I have a question. You, when somebody asks you to talk to them, what do? You sit down and visit them and give them a list of problems?
I put them through a catechism, Cindy. I tell them my terms. And if they want to get well on those terms, they've got a sponsor. And the first thing I say to them, I want you to get a big book. I want you to study the first 164 pages, then we'll talk. And that's how we start. And when they feel that they can get out of the emergency room, you know, quit using the slogans, which are mental first aids, and they'll do it till you can get in the program. And when they get ready to take the steps, we don't have any elevators, you know. I say get you an AA 12 Steps and 12 Traditions book and let's go to work. And that's how I sponsor people. I supplement it with Al-Anon literature because we've got to keep that office open some way so we have the referral staff, if nothing else. But if they don't want to get well on those bases, I don't believe in firing a sponsor. I think if you outgrow your sponsor, it's permissible to find someone to sponsor you, but I can't quite see myself going up to Margaret's rest home and saying, you're not my sponsor anymore. Margaret will be my sponsor as long as she lives. I may get help from another person, but I'll never give them the label sponsor. Okay?
Same for you, Don.
But
what do you do?
The rules.
Well, the rules, if someone asked me to be a sponsor, I'll tell them that I have to know a little bit about them. Simply because we don't sponsor everybody the same way in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sponsorship depends on the requirements of the individual who comes to you for help. And you must understand that. And what we tell them to do is anytime you have a problem that involves a lot of emotion, remember what we are emotionally handicapped people, and our objectivity is blurred when we get emotions involved. And so anything that requires a lot of emotion, come and talk about it, discuss it. Because the sponsor is not emotionally involved and can look at it objectively. For instance, you can give certain advice on some things, other things you can't. If somebody came to me and said, as I did one fellow, he came in and he said, you know, I'm getting tired of you always beating around the bush. And I want to know whether I should ask Vicki to get married or not get married. And I said, there's no way can I tell you to get married or not get married. All I can do as your sponsor is support your decision. There's nothing wrong with being single. There's nothing wrong with being married. You know Vicki a lot better than I do. And if you decide to get married, then let me be the first to congratulate you. If you decide you're not going to get married, I'll say that's fine, there's lots of other girls around. It's that simple. But we have to use the sponsorship a little differently. There's some things like, there's some people come in that are dead broke, and so what we have to do is we'll have a special session with them and teach them how to budget. Because that's the secret of all wealth. It has nothing to do with how much you earn, it's what you do with what you earn. And so we teach them how to become well-to-do. And that's by putting away a certain amount every month. And so we teach them how to budget. But everybody who comes to AA is not broke. And it's the same thing with these other things. Some people have problems that others don't have. And so you don't say to everybody, here, let me, you know, help you with your checkbook and teach you how to add and subtract, because they don't need that. But it's very important. We do have a sponsor. And the sponsors get to know you, because I know a priest, by the way, who will not do fifth steps with alcoholics. He's a member of AA himself. And somebody goes to him and say, Father, I want you to do my fifth step. And he says to him, have you got a sponsor? And he says, yes, I do, Father. Well, he says, you expect that sponsor to help you fix your life? And he said, yes, Father. He said, he's got to know what's broken before he can help you to fix it. So I won't hear your first step. You go to your sponsor and do it with him so he'll know how to help you. And I have a great deal of respect for that man because I believe in that. That's if you expect help from your sponsor, you've got to know what's the problem. And I agree wholeheartedly with Arbutus. We have no right to say who we sponsor or anything else. I can say who my sponsor is, but that's it. And it's not a counting thing. And we also tell people that get a temporary sponsor if you want in the group, but then after you've been around the group long enough, and if you see someone that you know that you would like to be like, that walks the walk and talks the talk, then if you want them to help you, ask them to be your sponsor. We have people that move around the country and we tell them to get a co-sponsor in cases like that. And the reason we have a co-sponsor is for certain things. They got everyday things, but usually for any major decision they have, they will telephone. They always do that. So it's
there's another area. You know, we say we share our experience, strength, and hope, and that's a great privilege. But sometimes it's restrictions. I cannot share an experience if I've never had it. And this was brought home to me a couple of weeks ago. I think the last time Cindy was talking to me, I think she sensed that I wasn't on top of things. And my little sister, who's retired now and bought a retirement home 30 miles away from me, and went through a legal separation from her husband when they lived in Arizona. This man, she couldn't live with him. But he got terribly sick and lonely. So he came to Texas and rented an apartment just down the street from her. And the last trip that he made to the doctor told him that his emphysema would never get any better, that his physical condition would gradually decline until he'd be non-functional. So he came back to the apartment and put a bullet through his head. Now, could I go to my little sister and say, I know how you feel? I could not. I cannot share an experience that I have not had. But when you are a sponsor, now I will not violate the confidence of the people I sponsor, but this is an area that I learned much from. I've never been in a divorce court, but some of the people that I sponsor have, and I can learn from them. Now, as long as I am careful about the anonymity, I might say to someone else that I sponsor, I've never been in a divorce court, honey, but I sponsor a woman who has, and she did thus and so, and it was helpful. Because when we share our experience, strength, and hope, we have to have had the experience before we can share it.
There's one other thing I might add. That in our group, what we do is what we call group sponsorship.
Yeah.
And that's if three or four fellows have a new sponsoree. Then they'll say, how about a session Saturday morning? What Saturday are you going to be in town? Can we come over to the office? We got some new guys. We want to talk to them for about an hour and a half. And it's not a regular AA meeting. It's just a come as you are, but it's just a stag meeting. And we talk about the facts of life. We explain to the boys the difference between boys and girls. I know they might, I'm not talking about the physical differences. We're all aware of that. I'm talking about the other differences, the emotional differences between males and females, and the reason they can't, how to get along with them, because if you're going to go and sell something in Japan, if I was going to sell cups in Japan, I'd be pretty stupid going over there trying to talk to a Japanese and American. If I was real smart, I'd learn Japanese and talk to the Japanese businessman in Japanese, then he's apt to buy the cups. And so we tell them the same thing, and then every so often our the older gals in our group will have a group of young gals, and they say, we want to have a meeting on a Saturday afternoon, just stag, just the gals, to ask questions and ask the differences between the males and females. And as I say, we're not talking about the physical differences, they're obvious, but there are great differences emotionally between males and females. And if you're going to date somebody, you better talk in their language, and vice versa, and we explain the differences to them. And they're not afraid to ask questions. And we always say that A wise person asks questions and appears foolish for a few moments. A fool never asks a question and remains a fool all his life. But usually in those sessions, those private sessions on Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon, no matter what question is one of the guys ask, it's on the minds of every one of the other guys there. And the same thing with the girls. They all want to know what the answer is.
And this is when we say we don't have any answers. We have solutions.
Yeah.
And we started having something, and I think we've heard it from this part of the country. It certainly did not originate in Texas. Not many of these things do. But we're having all women's get-togethers. They have various and sundry names, woman to woman, friend to friend, safe place for girls, and things like that. And now they're having them for the AA and Al-Anon men, like Brownwood, where I live. And this is the time that the AA ladies get some things off their chest that they can't ask in an AA meeting. They'll say, why do they treat me like a prostitute? Then some old hard-boiled Al-Anon member like me will say, it's because you act like one. You know, don't wear short shorts to the meeting and quit using so much makeup. And for God's sake, clean up your language. If you treat like a stepchild, it's usually because you act like a stepchild and other things. You usually get treated about like you expect to be treated. If you're sassy, people will sass you back. If you're angry with people, they'll give you tit for tat. If you're kind and gentle, you get that kind of treatment. And AA ladies are so vulnerable. And God, they're brave. I don't know if I could be an AA woman or not. You know, we have a double standard in this country, and I'm grateful for it. But, you know, if a woman gets drunk, she says, you know what? And if a man gets drunk, he's just one of the boys. And they're very vulnerable. And so many times you see a beautiful AA lady get involved much more than they'd like to be because they mistake gratitude for love. And they're grateful just for a kind word or a ride to a meeting or a cup of coffee because they haven't had that for a long time. And so this is when we say you don't get involved, you know, till you've been in the program for a while. And this is why you need a sponsor so very desperately. It isn't only AA ladies that get into this mix-up. A little gal's been shoved around by a brutal drunk for 10 years or so. The first AA single that's kind to her, look out, you've got a campus romance, and sometimes they don't work out.
That's the same thing we tell all our boys and girls. In your first year, we recommend no relationships because it's so difficult when you're an emotional retard to know whether you're in love or in heat.
Can't wait to use that.
And that's it. We just don't know the difference. And I never did because love is something we have to learn. And that's it. And most people don't know, most alcoholics, I should say, don't know the difference between being in love and being in heat. It's that simple.
And don't ever get the idea that those of us who love alcoholics were attracted to you. You were attracted to us. Because we weren't retarded.
What do you do with the guy you keep slipping all the time? The guy keeps slipping all the time? I have a very simple solution to it. If somebody comes to me and says, I keep having problems slipping, what is the problem? I say, that sounds very much like the fellow who keeps falling out of bed. You're sleeping too close to the edge. Get in the middle of the bed, get active in AA on a regular daily basis, and get involved in service work. And if you're right in the middle of the bed, you're not apt to fall out of bed. And if you're right in the middle of AA, you're not apt to fall out of it. It's very simple. Really, there's a simple solution. As Abir says, these are just solutions to these problems.
But you've got a great catch-all now for the losers. They can always go to the adult children group.
Of course, as far as I'm concerned, everybody, adult child, something or other. You know what I mean? Let's face it. Pardon? What steps?
Yeah, you said you get them into the middle instead of being on the outside. What do you do?
Get them involved in doing things in the group. Just say you get down there. Have you ever wondered where the coffee, how come the coffee was on when we get there at 7:45? You should get in there at 7:30 and help make that coffee. Be sure to help put the chairs away. We're going to go out and call on so-and-so tonight. We're going to do something else. You get busy. Stay in contact on a daily basis.
Take him to the jail.
Yeah, go to the jail meetings.
So he can see a drunk.
And try and get a newcomer. Drag in some newcomer. Yeah, stick right with him. Get him to meetings and everything else. You start worrying about him instead of you, and you'll be fine.